This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
History in every century records a night that lives forevermore. We'll recall as into line we fall the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
The Sammy K Orchestra with Remember Pearl Harbor, a rallying cry reverberating around America in the early stages of World War II. And perhaps you saw it a couple years ago when our guest today, Mickey Gannich, burst into song with those lyrics at the White House in front of the president. Mickey is 100 years old now, and you heard him say he just renewed his driver's license for 5 more years. And 5 days a week, he drives to the Oakland Senior Center to volunteer in the Disabled American Veterans Office. The building is almost as old as Mickey is. It's the Veterans Memorial Building in downtown Oakland, built in 1926. Out front, you'll find a torpedo port from the USS Maine, whose destruction spurred the Remember the Maine rallying cry for the Spanish-American War. So if you're ever in downtown Oakland to check out any of that history, make sure you step inside and find Mickey and get some living history. He was definitely living it on December 7th, 1941. So let's talk about how the farm boy from Ohio experienced this. You just turned 22 a few weeks before that.
Yeah.
So you're in your football pads getting ready for a scrimmage before the big game with the Arizona at 1. And what was your first indication that the Japanese were there?
Well, the living compartment of the courtroom, in fact, to be a quartermaster, let me tell you how I became a quartermaster. They asked me what I'd like to do. I got good grades. I took my education seriously. I got good grades in my tests, and they said, what would you like to do? I said, well, I'm not mechanically minded. I'd like to do something there that would not require mechanical aptitude there. They said, how you like to steer a ship? I said, that's great for me. Because back there in Ohio, the biggest thing we saw at Lake Erie was ferry boats there. And I said, oh, they said, yeah, how'd you like to steer a ship inside of the harbor, outside the harbor, out at sea? I said, that's for me. So they made me a quartermaster. So I went to quartermaster and signal school in San Diego. And then when I got on the ship there, one of the main duties there was steering the ship. And I ended up steering that 33,000-ton battleship in and out of the harbors there, all over the Pacific, it seemed like there. That's pretty good for a farm boy. And I never even saw anything bigger than a ferry boat up close. Mm-hmm. And then steer that 608-feet-long, 33,000-ton battleship. I thought that was pretty good for a farm boy.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't steer it on December 7th, though, because it was in dry dock.
Yeah, that's right. We had a propeller tow. Fortunately, normally when we were in port, we would tie up at a dock, 10-10 mm-hmm. dock. That's how long that dock is, 10 feet long. We always had an admiral aboard when we went out at sea because we were the flagship of the fleet. Mm-hmm. Whenever we came in port, we tied up at the dock there. But a couple of days before that, we had a propeller tow. They put us in dry dock with two other destroyers, casting in the Downs, saying we weren't in our normal place there. The ships had moved into the place where we normally did be. I torpedoed Ogallala in the hell and I got hit. They were the place where we would be because I found out later two Japanese airplanes were scheduled to hit the USS Pennsylvania. They wanted to make sure they knock out the flagship of the fleet because, you know, in your Indian movies, you knock out the chief, you got a better chance to win the war. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make sure that the Pennsylvania was hit. Well, the Ogallala was sunk, the Helena was damaged there, but they were aiming for us, but we weren't in our normal place, fortunately.
So for you, you started to tell me where the living quarters were and what your first alarm to this situation was.
We're going to leave the ship at 8 o'clock. takes about 4 or 5 minutes to get from the living compartment of the quartermaster's to get up on deck so we leave the ship at 8 o'clock. About 6 minutes to eight, the phone rang. I picked up the phone. One of the fellows on the deck was up on deck of our gang. Called on and said, Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor. I said, oh, come on, let's not talk about it, because we'd been talking about it for months there, but we feared there was no chance for us. About that time, the ship shuddered. Some of our fellows that were close to the guns went to the guns and started shooting at the planes before we knew below decks knew what was going on. About that time, General Quarters went, all hands man your battle stations. Now, get from there up to the poles there, which you, I guess you'd call it there, the mast there with the closeness, that's where I had to go. So by the time I got up there, ships were burning, planes were burning, planes were flying around there. Look close enough, you hit them with rocks. If you had anything to throw at them, I could have thrown my binoculars at them because I was a lookout. That was all I had up there. But by the time I got up there, just a few minutes time, because you're going and you're going double time or triple time, get up there in a hurry because you don't know what was going on. It was pretty hectic.
Yeah.
But I was well protected with all my padding on.
All your football pads.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A little trap door to get through there. Pull myself through with all the padding on. I couldn't go straight through. It wasn't that wide. So I pulled myself through with my trap door and get up there. And it was kind of bad looking, seeing planes coming all around you. And it got pretty rough. But the Japanese didn't know where we were the first attack that they had, because we weren't in our normal place. But evidently, some of the Japanese pilots reported to the aircraft carrier that there's a big ship in dry dock with two other destroyers. So the second attack, they hit us. Bomb missed me by 45 feet. Armor-piercing bomb, 500-pound bomb, came on past me. I'm on the crow's nest. Came way down, exploded way below me. If it exploded on contact, I wouldn't be here talking to you. It's kind of scary to see a big hole alongside of you there.
So but if it had been a conventional bomb as opposed to armor-piercing, it would have gone off on the deck and you would have been gonzo.
Yeah.
And as it stands, you're up on this crow's nest. So when that bomb detonates below deck, I'm sure that was quite an earthquake for you.
Oh, it really shook me, but we didn't know where it hit, because if I saw the bomb coming, I probably died right there. But it came on past me, and I saw the result of it, but I didn't see it happening.
And this whole time, because of your elevated position, you're seeing a whole lot of other things.
Yeah. In fact, my job was to look how to report anything of interest there I could report, or what it is of phones on the ship itself. It's sound-powered phones is what it is. I would see the plane coming over the top of the buildings, because the building's fairly close to us, too. I saw this plane coming over the top of the buildings. I reported to it there. They turned their guns around facing that direction. When he came past his buildings, pow, we got him. That's the only plane we knocked down there. If they had to train the guns around to get the plane, they'd never had it, but they had the guns trained in that direction. So when the plane come over that way, they got him. They were ready for him.
And
so
you gave him a good scouting report.
Yeah. So that made me feel pretty good. I did accomplish something.
Well, and if you hadn't, that plane might have done something to your ship, too.
That's right.
You know, you hear a lot about D-Day as the longest day. But I'm wondering how long December 7th, 1941 felt for you.
It felt pretty long there, but we're just glad, because in between there was about a 10-15 minute gap in between the first attack and the second attack. So I had a chance to look around and get below and change clothes, get out of my football uniform on and get in my regular clothes. And then you didn't really have time to think about it, but I saw the results there. I saw the hole alongside me where the bomb came. Saw machine gun nicks in the ladder where I climbed up to get up to the crow's nest. Whether it happened before I went up there, after I went up there, or during the time I went up, I don't know, but they didn't get me. That's kind of scary, too.
Yeah.
But we didn't see what could have happened there, but I forgot I had other plans for me. He's looking out for me.
Well, apparently he still is here at age 100. So if you looked from the crow's nest on the Pennsylvania around the harbor, what else did you see in those moments?
I see all these ships burning, all people shooting boats out in the water, picking up people that were blown off the ship there, all harboring, and see everything up high enough, gone about 70, 80 feet up in the air above the ground there, and that was enough to see over the top of these buildings that they had. So I had a bird's eye view of what was going on, so I could see what was happening there, and saw the USS Nevada, the battleship, and try to get outside the harbor, which is the foolish and craziest thing to do. If it had been sunk in a channel, nobody would have been able to get in and out. So they finally wised up and grounded it, run to the ground. Well, we feared it couldn't happen to us. Like I said, we'd been talking about maybe getting to war with Japan there for a long time. In fact, some of our people were even helping. Some of our people, like, to join the Flying Tigers there, mm-hmm, with General Chenalta. But since we were not in the war, they were on their own. In fact, some of our pilots went over to join the RAF, the Royal Air Force, flew with them, even though the country itself was not in the war, because we had sympathizers there, but we were not in a war itself, technically.
Which changed on that morning for you. And I know it's a long time ago, but I'm sure you still remember what that felt like. How frightening or alarming or just jolting was that?
Well, it really, you don't have, when that's happening, you don't have time to think about it. You're trained to do job. My job was to do this and do that. Same with the other people on the ship. But really, you don't think about it. All you can think about what could have been, and then think about the future, what you can do to get ready for the future. All you can do is prepare and do what you can there. Some people's job is to repair the ship. Some people work on the engine. My job at that particular time was a lookout, because that was the lowest position of my gang at that time, and I was the newest one in that gang. And so just think about what could have happened, but you don't think about it. You don't have time to think about it.
And I know you just returned from Pearl Harbor for the 78th anniversary, and I'm sure every time you go back, you see things and understand things maybe you didn't before. But one of the most striking photographs from December 7th is of the destroyer USS Shaw exploding.
Pieces of it there, when it exploded, fell on us. We were that close to it.
So you saw that happen in real time?
Well, I saw the result. I didn't see what, I didn't happen to be looking in that particular direction, because I'm looking around, see what else I can report there. So I didn't see it, but we saw pieces of it there that we recognized as pieces of the USS Shaw. That was quite an explosion.
When that second wave of the attack was done, was there concern that, we don't know if it's over? What happens next?
Well, we figure there's going to be an invasion. Mm-hmm. Getting ready. And in fact, that night, all people were instructed to go to the Army, get rifles and ammunition and canteens and stuff to get ready to go ashore to help the Army repel the invasion, because they figured it could be invaded.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, the Navy, when we're trained, we're not trained so much with rifles, all like the Marines in the Army there. So a lot of us there would be a detriment there, because we wouldn't be that capable of handling rifles and stuff like the Marines in the Army would there. So some of them were a little bit leery, and some of them never even had a gun in their hands or up close, and so everybody's a little bit leery about what we can do with this there. But we were ready, because we didn't know what to expect.
Well, sure. So that makes me curious about what the days and weeks that followed were like. What kinds of things were you doing? What were you hearing?
Well, just trying to fix it up the ship there, and wondering whether there's going to be anything more. Waiting for news of what was happening there, and we did find out there that blocks along there, see, we were attacked there, so the next morning Franklin Delano Roosevelt got Congress to declare war on Japan.
In one of the most famous and most frequently listened to speeches in history, which we're going to get a taste of when we come back. One thing I'm starting to realize, I think Mickey Ganich's story is one we're probably going to have to stretch over two episodes of Hometown Heroes, because I really don't want to leave anything out. When we come back, more of his perspective on December 7th, 1941, and what followed, and how Mickey learned of his connection to one of the men still entombed on the USS Arizona. Remember to visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video of this spirited centenarian. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.